I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Nice buns, soft, fluffy, and ultra low net carbs. Discover Hero Bread, the delicious ultra low net carb bread with incredible taste and texture. Hero Bread has 0 grams of sugar and is under 100 calories per serving. Plus, high in fiber with 5 to 10 grams of protein per serving. Available on Amazon.com, Walmart.com, and at Hero.co. That's Hero.co. Delicious, ultra-low net-carb Hero Bread, buns and tortillas. Soft and fluffy, high in fiber, and with 0 grams of sugar. Up to 10 grams of protein, coming in at under 100 calories. Order today at Hero.co and use the code AH10 to get 10% off your first purchase. That's AH10 at Hero.co. Hero.co. Order from Hero.co now and get 10% off your first purchase with promo code AH10. That's 10% off with code AH10. Hero.co.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Living in a box with Marcus Veer on keyboards and synthesizers, Anthony Titch Critchlow on drums, and Richard Derbyshire on vocals, formed in 1985 and released their first single, also titled Living in a Box, 2 years later. That track reached the top 5 in the UK and the top 40 of the Billboard charts. During my early years at MTV, their songs were played on heavy rotation. They released 2 successful albums and had a string of hit singles. But in 1990, when Derbyshire left, the band split in accordance with the contract they'd signed back in 85. In 2004, they reformed for a one-off gig with the original lineup. But this was not to be, and over a decade later, Titch and Marcus returned to the stage with a new vocalist, Kenny Thomas. This year, they're out on the road again, not with Kenny, as he had other commitments, but with Brian J. Chambers, who has sung for Pink Floyd, Beverly Knight, and who's been a backing singer for Prince, Mark Almond, and Grace Jones. The story of the band, and particularly Marcus Veer's story, is intriguing. He might call it luck, he might call it right place, right time, but in the end, it's also the story of a combination of the right talent. So Marcus Veer, Living in a Box, this is a great pleasure to talk to you because, you know, you created tracks that were very important to me in the 80s. And so, yeah, I mean, I'm going to enjoy this. I know I am. I hope you do too. We're somewhat of a similar age. I'm 3 years older, but I'm not going to quibble about it. You might. But I feel that we're of similar age. So we may have had some sort of similar experiences growing up. Now, you, I believe, grew up in Sheffield. What sort of town was it, and what sort of early years did you have in that town?
Sheffield, you know, in the 80s or late 70s and 80s when I was a teenager, was a really vibrant scene. I mean, I think that's part of the reason why we all got into music because we were influenced by our local bands. I mean, we had so many, you know, Martin Ware with Heaven 17, and before that, Human League. You know, there was a massive local band scene with ABC and so on. And, you know, the list goes on. And we were hugely influenced by that. And there was a really good sort of pub scene where you could nip out to the pub and you would see any number of great bands from, you know, Clock DVA to, you know, There Must Be Russians and all these kind of really funky name bands, and became, you know, some of them became really huge, you know, international stars. And, you know, I remember seeing ABC, one of their videos on Top of the Pops, walking by a sort of Rediffusion TV rental shop in the 80s and thinking, crikey, that's, that lad came from Sheffield. That's where I am. And it, no, it really does inspire you, you know. So, yeah, that was incredible. And we had the Limit Club, of course, which was probably 300 or 400 capacity club that had most of the bands that we all know of, from Elvis Costello to The Police to George Michael when he was going out with Wham, who probably played their first ever gigs there. And in fact, B-52s played what was sort of largely accoladed as their best ever gig at the Limit Club in Sheffield. And I remember being there to see that show. And, you know, it was just electric.
I want to come back to that in a little while. I'll come back to the Limit Club in a little while because I think I've jumped a bit here. What sort of music did your parents listen to, and when did your taste diverge from your parents?
My mother was a big Burt Bacharach fan, and I still am, really. I mean, there's glamorous 60s orchestral and horn arrangements and the movies that they were often attached to. Was just, you know, the glamorous side of the Living in a Box sound came from that, really, with the horns and the string arrangements, although we were moving on to synthesizers. So it's just the essence of what that brought to music was definitely Burt Bacharach or Burt Bacharach and Hal David songs. Yeah, and she was listening to some Supremes, Motown, you know, that kind of stuff. So I was really interested in the 3-minute pop song formula that was coming out of the States in the 60s. Yeah, my sort of sound diverged, I think, when I got influenced by what else was going on in the charts at the time. I was at school in 77 when punk had reached its massive apogee, and that was really exciting. It was so irreverent and anarchistic, and that was quite exciting. And I think in terms of the lyrics, which, you know, we'll probably get onto for Living in a Box, using words like that and ideas like that probably are a slightly post-punk sort of phenomena. And so I got that inspiration from all that I was hearing there.
I mean, I remember being at school, and everyone at school wanted to be a pop star. They didn't want to be a copy of someone. They wanted to be an original pop star. I mean, music played, particularly, I think, for our generation, probably more than any generation, such a massive role in our lives. Yeah. And also, I was fascinated by artists. And later on, I realized they represented something that I was hoping for when I was younger. For instance, yeah. David Bowie being the outsider, the alien, and I wanted mm-hmm. to get the hell away from my existence as a teenager, you know, with all these
exactly.
problems that I had. Was it similar for you, and who did you actually sort of hook onto musically at that point?
Well, I think you're right. I mean, this is some of, you know, arguments or discussions I have with my kids about music today, which we won't bore on. We all know the sort of churned out radio formatted stuff that comes out today that I have difficult differentiating between, certainly musically and certainly image-wise. And this because we don't have the individuality that we have now. I mean, it's arguable that the Ziggy Stardust or Hunky Dory for you know, Bowie, that, you know, they probably wouldn't even be able to get signed today. You know, so we were listening to a lot of music that was really individual. So there were people presenting themselves, it was the fashion they were wearing, the look they got, the videos they were making with the MTV culture. And the brand loyalty that went along with that. If you were into a band, you listened to every aspect of their record, you looked at that sleeve, you were wearing what they're wearing, or whether you were a goth, or whether you were a new romantic, and the whole Spandau thing and the Blitz Club in London was taking off at the time, which was hugely exciting to me to be able to, even though I was up in Sheffield, we all heard about it and the local scene. In a way, with the Leadmill later and the Limit Club before it, the you know, the whole clothing and the whole thing that came from that. And, you know, obviously with Culture Club coming up, it was like, wow, you know, we've got somebody here who's, you're not quite sure gender wise, amazing sort of influences with the reggae and ska, with pop music. And it was all these wonderful blends that were going on that people were seemed to be experimenting and coming up with the 80s music that, you know, when we're doing these sort of tours now, I just listen to that one thing that sort of threads them together, which is the 80s You know, it's unmistakably 80s, but there is so much diversity in the sounds and the way and the formats that the people were using to write their songs and express themselves. It was incredible.
One thing, one person you mentioned is Martin Ware, who I know is a good friend of yours. Martin, of course, is, you know, one of the greats in electronic music, and what he's actually achieved throughout his life has been immense. But he mentioned to me about a sort of a youth arts centre called the Meat Whistle, I think it was called, which was in Sheffield at the time.
Right.
He used to go. And this was something that brought him in contact with other people of, you know, the same type who were interested in developing music. Did you have, let's say, a sponsor or a mentor or someone around you who really, it might have even been a teacher, someone who sort of pushed you to be creative, or maybe even your parents?
Well, I think it was when I was learning to play piano. I mean, at school, when I was very, very young, I got one of those Bon Tempi organ, nasty little things, started playing Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star and all that kind of stuff when I was very young. And then I went to school and I couldn't really play the keyboards. They made me play the piano, which was a good thing because the learning certain, I got up to about grade five, which is not by by any means genius, but it was enough to give me the basics and the technical ability to express myself. But I think, you know, obviously from an instrumental point of view, you've got to be able to do it, otherwise you remain perpetually frustrated. And I got to about grade five and my piano teacher said to me, you're going to give this up, aren't you? And it was, because of playing all the classics. And I thought, well, this is getting a bit tedious now. So he said, look, let's forget this. Let's go and get listen to some stuff in the charts. I'll teach you all about harmonics and harmony and you know, how to improvise and all this kind of stuff. And it was that moment that kept me into music, where I'd hit that T-junction where I wouldn't be talking to you today if it wasn't for him. So, yeah.
Now, you mentioned the Limit Club. I presume this came after school, and you know, had you sort of studied and had your O levels or A levels or whatever we did at that time, and then you worked for the Limit Club, or did that come, what age were you when you actually went there?
So I did my A levels, left school at 18. I wasn't really ever going to be a university person, as my kids who are now sending to university, I was saying I went to the University of Life, and I go, yeah, great excuse, Dad, for titting around in the Limit Club. But I started work at the Limit Club when I left at about 18, and handing out flyers and putting up their fly posters, anything really to get involved with what I'd found to be a complete magnet for creativity in the music scene in Sheffield in the 80s.
Did you ever get into trouble for doing that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, there was like a Manchester mob and a Sheffield mob who'd be out in the middle of the night putting up those by 40 by 30 quads or whatever size they were, slapping on the, you know, the wallpaper paste, sticking on a poster and then doing a runner. And then the Manchester squad would come and stick their stuff over the top, you know, and then, we, you know, all that kind of stuff and handing out flyers and all that kind of thing. It was great. It was really exciting because you could you could sort of feel that you're part of something. You knew what was coming up that no one knew. And I sort of went from there really to being asked to sort of get involved in, because I was a young kid and they were slightly older, the owners of the club said, well, you know, you seem to be into the scene. What should we be putting on here? And I suddenly started getting involved with actually booking the bands at the Limit Club, which was really exciting because it gave me a relationship with all the agents in London, which I didn't know at the time, but would eventually become really useful to me with Living in a Box in terms of meeting business people. And then they bought the Lyceum Theatre, and I started working, really booking all bands at the Lyceum Theatre for a while. And then they were booking shows all over the North of England as well. They set up a separate promotions company, which I was sort of involved in quite heavily with doing, you know, the Clash at Leeds Queen's Hall or whatever, whatever. And it was through that I met Titch and started the band.
In terms of the bands that were there, you mentioned some. I know there was, you know, U2, Kid Creole, the B-52s. I mean, there was a sort of a massive diverse mixture of artists that, sure, I presume you had the opportunity then of seeing live. What did you glean from their, I know they were on the a lot of them were on the way up in their careers at that time. They weren't necessarily, sure, at the pinnacle. It was one of, yeah, the sort of early days. What did you glean from the performances, do you think, that has become useful in your life? And what did you understand from them by being around them?
Well, as you say, there was a huge diversity of music. So some of the sort of more sort of schizophrenic nature of a Living in a Box album. So you've got the ballads and the sort of West Coast R&B flavoured ballads in one end, and you've got the sort of more frenetic hardcore beats of Living in a Box and Generate the Wave and Gay Crashing, which has got the other side. So I think it was the diversity of artists that I was seeing that made this Living in a Box not necessarily cleanly identifiable, because it's got quite, there's quite a big wide spread of influences in what we do. And so I think it was seeing the bands live. First of all, you know, seeing live music is just insane. I mean, it's insane when you're 18 or 20 years old, and it's still as magical to me today as it was then. So seeing them, being involved in the backstage, putting them on, understanding what a rider is, organizing, you know, the sound and getting the crew in early, and then dealing with the public, selling tickets, promotions, you know, that gave me a very rounded idea of what it is from one end, just taking on the music and enjoying it as a punter, but also getting involved from a business aspect and what really goes into putting on a show.
But did you want to be a pop star, or did you want to create music?
Yeah, instantly. I just suddenly thought, yeah, I can play the piano. And rather sort of selfishly and probably, although as it turned out, it was okay. I thought, well, I can do that. I can understand that with music, we all have some kind of, it's like magic, right? Music is, to me, is magic. Some people can be involved in the magic and create it, and others can't. It's, you know, we can all do different things, right? You know, but I just sort of thought, I can do this. I can do it. I can see the way that I want what I do to get me up on that stage.
I mean, it's funny because I've been, obviously, you know, in my work throughout my life, I've interviewed, you know, really many, many pop stars. And I've always had the feeling that most are incredibly regular people, but then you find people that are, that break a little bit under pressure, because there is an immense pressure on someone being in the public eye, being on stage, creating music, and also the problems that come with that, because you're not always, no one's always successful with what they create. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
So
absolutely,
that can
yeah.
also be a problem. Did you manage to talk to them about who they were, or were you sort of in a position where you could just observe?
No, I was very much a junior partner in the whole experience. Even though I was actually booking the acts, I would deal more with the tour manager than I would with the artists. The artists, even though, as you say, they were on the ascent in their careers, I was too busy just making sure that the show went well from a business point of view. But then at the end, while the band were actually on, it was that was the point where I was going, you know, I'm wearing two hats here. I'm watching what's going on. I'm hearing the music that's influenced me, and partly choosing the bands because I love what they do and I wanted to be involved in their tours in Sheffield or wherever else we were promoting them. And then I was going on with my business hat and going, right, so how much money? What's the break even today? How much cash do they want? So, you know, and all sorts of craziness that would go on in the 80s, you know, dealing with artists from a sort of more of a managerial point of view, rather than me having time to go, so, yeah, Kid Creole, tell me about the coconuts. They look like really hot babes. I mean, you know, do you, don't you? I mean, you know, it was, or Shalimar, who would come over, and I was, oh, yeah, Night to Remember. Love that tune, man. You know, I might get to say that. But beyond that, I didn't really get into it, into any deep, meaningful convos with them.
And now, an Etsy holiday gifting mission. Today's episode, Operation Handcrafted and Affordable. Here's the situation. It's the holidays, which means you're on a mission to find handcrafted, affordable gifts. You want items that will brighten the spirits of everyone on your list, but won't blow your budget. Sure, it sounds impossible, but there's no need to make shopping for gifts feel like it has the suspense and high stakes of a heart-pumping action franchise. It's time to simplify your gifting experience with Etsy. Whether you're searching for handmade home pieces like serveware, cutting boards, and throw pillows for your favorite holiday hosts, or personalized items like necklaces, handbags, and seasonal jackets for your most stylish friends and family, Etsy has it. Get handmade items for all budgets and any gifting mission. New to Etsy? Use the code HOLIDAY10 for 10% off your first purchase. That's code HOLIDAY10. Maximum discount value of $50 expires December 31st, 2023. See terms at Etsy.com/terms. Shop Etsy.com. Etsy has it.
It's the most wonderful time of the year, Christmas. And what better way to get into the holiday spirit than with a Minky Couture blanket? Whether you're gathered around the tree with loved ones, roasting marshmallows by the fire, or just looking for a cozy way to stay warm on a chilly night, Minky blankets are the perfect addition to your Christmas festivities. With a wide range of festive designs and colors, you can find the perfect blanket to match your holiday decor or gift to your loved ones. So this Christmas, make your holiday even cozier with a Minky Couture blanket. Head to MinkyCouture.com now and find your perfect blanket just in time for the holiday. Happy holidays from Minky Couture.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
Were you already writing music at that stage?
Well, I was writing. Yes, I was, actually. It was, although it was, strangely, I was sort of more influenced at that particular time by some of the West Coast virtuoso musicians. So someone like Larry Carlton, who's a sort of jazz guitar aficionado. And we had a little band that I set up in my dad's warehouse that started off, that was just playing live, like Greg Phelan-Gaines, the Crusaders, that kind of a sort of really nice sort of Rhodesy chops and beautiful guitar parts. And Titch got involved and started playing the drums. So we had a little trio, but it wasn't actually formulating 3-minute pop songs that were commercially, sensible in that way. It was more just sort of getting into the music and the skill and getting into a musical fantasy land in a way. It wasn't I say songwriting per se. It was just getting our chops going on our musical instruments. It's very instrumental based. That later came into play because like I was saying to you before, grade five on the piano doing classics is one thing. Then going into a bit of a jazzy kind of like, let's just get these musical chops going and enjoy just not writing a formatted three-minute pop song, to eventually doing exactly that. There was a process.
So when did you actually meet Titch, and what was your impression of him? I don't know if you met him at school or you met him actually sort of later because of this live venue.
Yeah, well, I met him because we were doing the Clash at Leeds Queen's Hall, and that particular tour was, they wanted local band support. And so because I was really involved in the local band scene, it was fairly easy for me to get tapes together of local bands and reach out through the Star in Sheffield or whoever else it was. I can't remember. We just said we're looking for support for this. So, of course, we were flooded by demo tapes. And one of the demo tapes was a band called Typhoon Saturday, who Titch was playing drums with at the time. I actually found out where the promotions office was and came in and said, listen to this, man, this is just going to be, you know, we'd love to do the support. At the end of the day, they didn't get the support, but I thought the drums were amazing. And in a totally selfish way, I was going, I could really do with a drummer as good as that. And I said to him, look, we can't put you on at this show, but I am putting something together. And in the meantime, he was working on the Moor, on a market stall in Sheffield. And we were at the Lyceum Theatre, and I said, do you want a gig as a, like, do you know what a follow spot is? And he said, no, what is it? He said, well, you know, when you're on stage and you follow people around with the spotlight, the CSI follow spots. So they're big, massive things in those days that, you know, got up to about 300 degrees centigrade and burn your face off. So he said, yeah, well, it's, I don't know what it was, £5 an hour, which was quite good then. So he came down and he got on the follow spots into the Lyceum Theatre for some show or other. And we started chatting and getting on, and it's like, he was like me, really into it. And we just became really good mates. And was, you know, as you do, you start talking about music and all that kind of thing. We got on so well that we started to put a little band together. And I remember Live Aid being on at the time, and as me going around to his, or him coming around to my house, and I was watching Live Aid going, Jesus, this is amazing. I mean, look at what's going on. The artists are incredible. We've got to get a piece of this. Surely we can do this. And was that 84? I'm not sure if it was, somewhere around there. Anyway, so we hit it off really well and started rehearsing, started playing. And then we did that jazz thing, which I was talking about. And then we got into a studio and started recording songs, and, you know, for about a year or so. That's how we met, basically through me being in the promotions business and him being applying to be a, you know, support act.
What was the moment that you realized that what you were writing could be successful in the right combination with the right people and so on and so forth?
I think when I'd first written the backing track to Living in a Box as a backing track, actually, for, this sounds so out there, but we had a friend of ours who had a hotel chain who we'd met on holiday. Me and Titch went away to Greece, and he got a couple of Sheraton hotels in New York. And he took pity on us. I think he thought, well, here are a couple of down at heel musicians and they'll never do anything. But listen, so he said, why don't you look, we've got opening a new bar. Why didn't you write a jingle for this bar in the States? And we'll put it on the radio. We'll pay you for it. And so I went away and wrote what was the backing track to Living in a Box. So somewhere out there is a jingle with the backing track of Living in a Box on it. And they paid us for it. And then I started thinking, as I was listening to that backing track, Titch and I were in the studio. I took it home. I had about a week or so before this, had a conversation with a mate who said, you know what, I feel like I'm living in a box. And he was living in Hyde Park Flats in Sheffield. And I didn't think anything more. It's just something that sort of stuck in my head. And as I started to sing over that track, I sort of worked, I thought, well, that just sits so tightly on that beat. And, you know, you just got to have that moment where the lyrics and the music cannot be separated. And you think, well, that is pretty awesome. And I remember saying to Titch, right, this is how it goes. And I sang it to him over the top. He said, you can't have cardboard in a song. I mean, what sort of shit is that? And I went, well, no, you can have cardboard in the song, because that's precisely why. Because that's the one that is the earworm where people go, what? Oh, yeah, I can relate to that. You know, I understand what living in a box is about and what that means to me. And that was probably the moment when it was like, wow, I think we've really got something here. Although it wasn't really until Richard sang on it in the demo studio that it was then it was like, okay, no, not only got the melody, the song, the lyric idea, which is a bit kooky, then this dude sings on it. Wow. Now we're in business.
Were there other words that came up apart from cardboard?
No, because I was looking for that syllable that just dropped on that. And that's, I think it was sort of slightly biographical, autobiographical. You know, I was at home in just outside Sheffield in my mum's house. I hadn't really left home then. I mean, I sort of had a girlfriend in Sheffield, so I was doing going toing and froing. My mother's house is about 12 miles outside. And I was feeling, you know, like you said, you know, we're frustrated with my life. And I wanted to break down the what I would perceive were just sort of almost was like some kind of feeble mindset that was the only thing that was stopping me getting to where I wanted to go. And that is the cardboard box, you know, that it is breaking through the cellophane line. Again, cellophane, I'd stick another weird word in there. So that's what it was all about, really. And it just sort of came. And I think I wrote the song. I mean, literally, once I'd got it, maybe an hour. I got it down. I was like, gee, I can't get it out of my head. This is awesome. And that to me was the, you know, as we went on to and record it, it became what it became.
I mean, you mentioned Richard Derbyshire. What did you know about him before that moment? Because he was in the same studio.
He was,
time,
yeah.
Yeah,
he came in after us. We were just, I think we were reeling off. We were looking for other singers and we got other people in and I'd put a guide vocal on Living in a Box. Really reeling off the quarter inch or the half inch tape as it might have been in those days, and Richard was waiting to come in next, and we'd heard about this amazing guy, and we'd got an engineer who said, oh, there's this guy coming in, you know, I don't think there's a chance that he'd do your stuff because he's a bit more middle of the road, a little bit more Chicago, a little bit more, you know, and he's got the most insane, he's Michael McDonald, he's a, you know, a white kid but you think he's black, and it's like, oh wow, okay, so we met him and here comes this blonde Elvis amazing guitar player walks in. He said, Marcus, I love that tune, that is so on it, mate. He said, well, I said, would you stick a guide vocal on it? And he said, all right, well, I've got 10 minutes, let's see how it goes. So he stuck a vocal on it, and of course it's just like, oh, my god, I mean, it's done, we're done. And I said to him, you know, were you up for, I don't think I said anything at the time because I think he was trying to crack on with the session, but I got hold of him the next day and said, this just sounds incredible, you up for doing something together? And he said, well, I'm looking for a solo deal. And on my own, I'm not really interested in being in a band. And I said, well, we've got the song, you've got the voice, honestly, mate. And he went, yeah, I can see what you're saying. So I said, if we can just do another couple of demos and I can go to London with Titch and we can try and get a record deal, you carry on doing what you're doing with your stuff. And if you get a record deal and you fly with your stuff, well, tough luck to us, but it's almost a first across the post. If I can get a deal with this, we didn't have a name or anything. And he said, well, if you can get a deal, I'm in.
And, did you ever think about the dangers of having three people where two of them are friends and one of them is an outsider? I know immensely talented and so on, but did it ever come up in your mind, could this be a dangerous sort of partnership?
Absolutely. I mean, it really did. And it turned out to be so. I mean, there was always Titch and I, and then there was Richard. I mean, listen, let's get up to it. We had the most amazing time and we still remain great friends to this day, but there was always going to be a little bit of Richard wanting to do a solo career and do his solo thing, and he's a songwriter in his own right, and so yes, there was, but we just took advantage of the moment we were in, you know, to be honest. It was just like, listen, this guy is just so good, I could wait around for another couple of years and never find anyone as good as that, who, you know, who was a lovely guy and is a lovely guy, you know. And it, you know, so yes, there was always at the back of our mind, both Titch and I spoke about it at the time. It's like, this might not be for the long term, but let's just go with it.
Now, you mentioned before that working at the Limit Club, you got to know agents, you got to know people that were connected to these stars that were working there, and these people were in London. Were those the people then that you went to initially? Who did you go to actually get a deal? Did you go straight to record companies? Did you go to someone else?
Titch and I jumped in a car once. We got Living in a Box, Generate the Wave, and one other, I can't remember, off the first album, and jumped in a car. And in those days, it's not as easy now, but I suppose you could still do it. We arrived in London. For some reason, we came off the M1, drove through into the centre of town, stopped up in Holland Park, and there was a red phone box, which is still there to this day, and got in it and opened up the yellow pages and started at A for A&M, met them, can't remember what B, C for Chrysalis, and we got a record deal. We'd also talked to MCA and Virgin, and it all got a little bit crazy. They all went freaked out and went, this is a hit, we've got to sign you. And we had to get a manager who then had to hide us in a hotel, because it all got quite, you know, Simon Draper and Richard Branson invited us down onto their hallowed barge in Maida Vale, and we talked to them. So it was literally, yeah, listen to us, we're here, we're Northern lads. And they, you know, they still to this day, Chris Wright would go, I remember you walking in, you know, you're about 2 foot off the ground, you knew you'd got something, and we thought, okay, we'll listen to it. You know, can you imagine trying to do that nowadays? It's all like, oh no, sorry, you've got to know the right people, and it's all a bit digital, and you know, send me some stuff, how many followers have you got? We just literally tore the doors down and went, listen to this. And yeah, everybody we played it to just loved it and got it totally.
I mean, the way that you say that is a sort of one-sided way, because there's three guys, you know, that, well, let's say, you know, you and Titch is particularly coming down from Sheffield, going to get a deal and being excited, you know, being 2 foot off the ground, being excited. Record companies weren't always full of nice people. Do you know what I mean? And I know you weren't completely green, but were you aware of the deal, and were you aware of what you were signing into and what you were sort of entering at the beginning?
Yeah, I mean, we started with a publishing deal because they helped broker the final deal, and we got Chris Morrison, who managed, you know, Major and Ultravox and had managed Thin Lizzy, and, you know, was doing, you know, did really well in terms of helping us understand what we were getting into. In retrospect, we made a mistake possibly with going with Chrysalis, because at the time they were absolutely a mess in the States. So we never really got to get a piece out of that pie, which was over 50% of the world market at that time. So we were recouping out of less than half of the world when that Living in a Box turned out to be a hit in every country of the world, although it only got to number 17 in the charts in the States. And then they pulled the independent pluggers off, and then that was the end of that. So even though they were doing well with Billy Idol and Huey Lewis in the News, and they were absolutely smashing it out of the park, unless you were signed in the States by Chrysalis, if you were signed in the UK, they kind of felt like they'd inherited something that they then got to go and sell, and didn't really matter. They didn't have any personal investment in it. And that was very much, in hindsight, a mistake to sign with Chrysalis. But we were happy that we had got the record off the ground. Listen, we had a hit record, a great career with them, but it was limited in terms of what we felt we could have done in the States. I mean, remember that we're Living in a Box, when that foot record first broke in the UK, was on Tony Blackburn's Radio London show, and he had Bobby Womack in the studio at the time, and he played the 12-inch Arthur Baker mix of Living in a Box three times back-to-back, which he's never done before or since, and Bobby Womack decided to go off and take the record and try and put out a 7-inch version of that with MCA in the States before we got our record out. So anyway, Chrysalis ended up having to injunct that, but the process we went through with Chrysalis, we really had a great time with them, and we did very well in everywhere else. But the big bugbear with us, and part of the reason why we didn't really go beyond the second album, was because we just couldn't recoup in the States. And Richard particularly found that hard to swallow. It's like, we've given you a great record that's perfect for the States. And listen, to this day, people still in America know the song really, really well. But we didn't feel we got our just desserts there. So that was the big mistake.
How did you get to work with Richard James Burgess?
That was a sort of, you'll be working with Richard James Burgess, who, by the way, is currently in West Hollywood. And we're going, right, great. Fantastic. We're freezing our yin-yangs off in Sheffield. were just looking at trying to buy houses in or rent house flats in London, and about 2 weeks later in West Hollywood. It was, I mean, he'd done Trapped Colonel Abrams, to be less flippant about it, which we thought was a great record that sounded really mighty, like we wanted to sound. So that was the key, really. It was just like, okay, well, also he's, you know, the original idea was just to go and record a single, go and record Living in a Box. But we got on with him so well and we had such a good time, we were reluctant to come back to the rain. So I think we were, you know, quite happy to go and record with Richard.
He'd also done, you know, I mean, he was really one of the first major producers in the era of new romanticism, wasn't he? To cut along.
That's right. I mean,
he
started with Landscape.
Yeah.
Sorry,
I know. He's worked on some fabulous things. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, he'd worked on some fabulous things. I think we found personally that when we actually got to it, I don't know, because we've actually just found, we think, the original demo of Living in a Box, which I still haven't heard, but Titch's brother's just moving house in Derbyshire, and he said it's in the loft. I can see it. I can't wait to hear it, because in my head, I always thought it was even better than the finished master. And I think sometimes when you, as in a recording artist, if you've done a great demo and you've got all that energy, and that was the one that got you the record deal, you are emotionally attached to it. And then you've got to start again. The technology wasn't such, especially for us recording on an 8-track, that you could just put the stuff out like you can now, or tinker with it and stick it out, because you recorded it on a Mac in digital pristine land. So going over it again and recording the whole things again was sort of, well, we found that quite hard work, and we're never really satisfied with the finished record. We also had some technical issues. I think the engineer was blowing a lot of coke up his nose at the time. So we ended up having to get Tom Lord Alge, who just won an award for Back in the Highlife against Steve Winwood, who just won a Grammy for that, to mix or remix it, because we had to do a lot of re-recording to get it to the point where we could put it out.
Now, you said that you went to LA, you just signed a record deal, you went to LA. Yeah, and at that point, you hadn't had a hit, obviously, because it was pre. But you'd gone to LA, and there you are. You're probably on cloud nine, I would have thought, going there, totally. Thinking, oh, God, this is amazing. What a life. What happened in LA?
Well, LA, well, listen, I don't know how far we can go on this conversation.
Go as far as you like.
Well, you know, LA in the 80s, what can you say? It was insane.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I mean, you know, I think we'd arrived with a tour manager who'd come from the management company with us, who literally introduced us to some girls that you used to know at the Cat and Fiddle, which is the English pub in Hollywood at the time. And we arrived knowing nobody, and we left, and we threw a party for over 500 people about 6 months later. So we got very much into the scene. You know, here are three English boys with English accents who've just got a record deal. I mean, we weren't manhole cover designers. Do you know what I mean? So, you know, if you're going to Hollywood, you want to be in the business. I would hate to just go there as a punter. I mean, you are, you know what it's like. And everybody wants to know who you are. Okay, you haven't got a record out yet, but here are these three English kids who've got a hot record deal, and they're recording in Hollywood, and they've got, you know, $1,000 a week per DMs each, and they've got a flash car to drive around in, and a nice apartment. It's like, well, what's not to like, you know? So we were invited to virtually every party. We, you know, we were living in a box, I think it was probably more of an happy, a better name for us. So we were at every opening. We went to the Chanel's house, which had a river running through it. We went to Sammy Davis Jr.'s place to his party.
What was that like?
We invited up to the Magic Castle, you know, where they do all the, where that's all based up there. You know, we got into a real scene. And I can remember there was a club called the 2020 Club, and there were all these artists would play. The house band was Earth, Wind and Fire, if you can imagine that. Prince would get up and do a track. Chaka Khan would get up and do a track. And it's just like, oh God, you know, is this actually happening? And, you know, of course, the musicians that we'd all seen on record labels, Paulinho da Costa on, you know, on albums, or, you know, whoever, you know, there was loads of them. You know, we used the backing singers from Luther Vandross's band, and we used the Sea Wind Horns from Earth, Wind and Fire. It was just like, yeah, you know, this is amazing. You know, this is absolutely insane.
I mean, one of the really fascinating things about what the record company did is that they pushed you in a sense with a sense of anonymity.
Totally.
So could you just tell me about that?
Well, yeah, again, possibly another mistake. I mean, I think one of the first mistakes, and I would advise against anybody using an eponymous band name. So Living in a Box, by Living in a Box, we couldn't come up with a name. We just couldn't. we probably should have worked a bit harder, and flippantly went, ugh. And they went, why don't you call you Living in a Box by Living in a Box, which is great in terms of drumming the first hit through. But when you start going Living in a Box, Room in Your Heart, Living in a Box, Blow the House Down, it's like, oh, what? And I'm sure Big Country maybe have had the same problem and others. So that wasn't ideal. What was the question again?
That you were pushed with a sense of anonymity. You know, right. You were almost like a black band from America, but you weren't.
Well,
you
that was
three
white
guys.
That was another sort of clever little marketing ploy. So we had the weird thing with the band name. The second thing is with Living in a Box, the first single, they wanted to put out the 12-inch Arthur Baker mix out on a white label by mailing it in from New York with a New York stamp on it to all the clubs in the UK so that the UK DJs thought we were an American band. And it was at that time there was so much going on in the music scene in New York and the underground dance scene that it was just cool to be, you know, coming from the States. They probably would, the chance, they, I think they hedged it, and then, well, if they're three white middle-class white boys from Sheffield, you know, does anybody care? We've got an absolute monster on our hands. But if we don't know who they are, it's totally anonymous. It's mailed in from New York. Maybe they'll play the record. And they did. And it went number one club, which was a great springboard then to people like, the radio DJs and go on to radio from the club scene, like Tony Blackman and so on, as we talked about. But, you know, you pay a price for that anonymity because they want to think it then sort of, well, we were seeing Curiosity Killed the Cat all over the front page of Just 17 magazine or whoever else. And we weren't doing any of this. Richard, of course, was the most sort of publicity shy pop star that's ever existed in humanity, and actually was quite happy to not have any images or be doing photo shoots or all that kind of thing. Titch and I sort of went along with it. We just thought, well, this is fine. But, you know, after a while, even to this day, people don't really know what Living in a Box looked like. I mean, we can walk out on stage, hey, it's Living in a Box, and they go, yay! It's like, oh, right, oh yeah, sort of. And it's a bit of a weird one. But I don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing, to be honest. It's just the way it was for us.
I think there's a positive side to it as well, because being in the public eye, although, you know, I think a lot of people, you know, sort of see that as an ideal, that they would like to be well-known, they'd like to be, you know, famous in some sort of way. Being in the public eye does have a side to it that isn't that comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
So maybe that was also something that allowed you to have a private life as well.
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, we would just do the interviews that we thought we wanted to do that were not particularly, pop orientated. So we do some more of the music tech magazines, or we do The Face or Q magazine. That was in the UK. And other territories, they took the handbrake off completely. And I remember in Japan, it was madness. I mean, they, you know, would split us up when we'd fly over to Japan, and we wouldn't see each other for 3 days because we would all be doing separate photo shoots, separate interviews, separate TV interviews, so they could maximize the amount of time that we were there. Italy, a little bit like that. And then there were occasions when it was, you know, yeah, police outrider protection and all this kind of nonsense. So, I think you're right. I mean, we could walk around Notting Hill having a great old time and just, you know, I mean, watch ourselves on Top of the Pops. You go out, nobody know who you were. I mean, Top of the Pops probably was the first time they were like, ah, that's what they look like. But of course, by that time, you've got a top five record and everybody going, yay, this is great. But I never knew there were three white kids from Sheffield. In fact, I think up on Wikipedia had us down from Manchester up until about the week before last when somebody kindly changed it. Although Richard was originally from Stockport, so maybe they got it from there. But yeah, the anonymity thing never really bothered us that much. But it's a bit of a weird one sometimes when people don't know who you are.
I bet it was one of those people who were putting up the posters from Manchester back then who wrote that Wikipedia entry.
Yeah,
just to piss you off after all these years. I mean, you said that, and I think that's an interesting point about Living in a Box, because it's Living in a Box and the Living in a Box track, and that you get known for one thing.
Living in a Box album as well.
Yeah, you made some fantastic tracks at that time. Do you think then that really was part of the reason, or you mentioned the record company and the record company not being able to, Chrysalis not really being able to promote like Room in Your Heart in America, it was a hit in Britain, wasn't it?
It was a hit all over the world. I mean, it's one of the biggest songs. I mean, just even in terms of what, when you see your PRS and you see where things are being played and the longevity that song has had, it's probably the song I'm most proud of. And it was a big record everywhere. except the States, when I think they managed to get it to 67 or something. And of course, by this stage, when you're looking, you know, obviously we were not in LA on a freebie, you know, you're paying for that. You could really do with recouping from the whole world and making sure that every territory is doing the best to make to sell your records. And when I think we'd gone over on some unfortunate West Coast promo tour in the States, and they just tanked Room in Your Heart. And I remember Richard being like so fed up. It's like, what are we doing, guys? I mean, you know, the bill is huge. We're doing well everywhere. We've always wanted to have some success. We worked with Albert Hammond on Room in Your Heart, and he, you know, was having hits that were just absurd. You know, I mean, he'd written the Olympic theme for Whitney Houston. He'd written To All the Girls I Loved Before, and started with Little Arrows and ended up in, you know, yeah, just writing hit after hit. Tina Turner, you know, go on and on and on. Aswad had that big hit, Don't Turn Around. He'd written that. So he was well used to having hits. And when we'd finished, I'd finished with him writing Room in Your Heart, he said, my God, this is probably my favorite record that I think I've probably ever written. And for a guy like that to then be told that Chris's record had fumbled it to number 67, it's like,
if you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
What are we doing?
Was that why Richard came out of the band? The 5 years were up, and you were recording the third album, I believe. Was there a particular moment? Well, there must have been a particular moment where it ended. Do you remember that moment and what exactly happened?
Yeah, I mean, Richard has sort of made noises to us before about, you know, and I couldn't disagree with it. It was like, listen, we're getting on fine. We love each other and we're having a great time. And the musical aspects of what we're doing were very converged. I think there was two forces at play. One, which we've just gone over, which is the issue in the States. The second one was that Richard definitely wanted to get more songwriting of his songs on the record. And I'd written the hits. And so therefore I was principally earning the most money out of it, to be brutally honest with you. And I think Richard always felt, look, I'm fronting this. I'm singing your songs and I really want more songwriting. And Richard's songwriting center was much more AOR, middle of the road, than where mine was. And so when I said, Richard, you know, obviously trying to appease to a certain degree, well, let's do some more stuff like you would do. And then suddenly Living in a Box starts to become something else. And I think at that point, I was beginning to resist how far we would go into going where Richard wanted to go musically. And Richard just said, look, I think I'm going to have to call it a day. And then let's get also brutal money-wise. Whenever any artist signs a record deal, they are signed jointly and severally. And I think Richard was picking up, if he left the band, Chrysalis got first choice. Because obviously they've spent all the money getting Living in a Box to where they are. Richard is a name to some degree. And they give him, you know, they were going to give him a big check, which they ended up doing. And so he managed to short circuit ever having to put anything out. He gets a big lump of cash. He gets to do a solo album and we lose our singer. And I said to him at the time, I said, Richard, not even Mick Jagger has managed to leave the Stones and have a successful solo career. George Michael has just done it, but you're going to count the numbers of artists, Steve Winwood probably, but very few who leave a band environment, solo artist, and go solo and have a successful career. And he went, I probably am making the biggest mistake, but I'm going to do it anyway. And I went, okay, what can I do?
I mean, in that sense, he left you, for a better sort of phrase, he left you a little bit in the shit. You know, you'd had these 5 years of massive success, and those 5 years, and I don't think they do define you, because we'll come to that later, but these 5 years in that sense at that time had defined who you were. So how did you, I know that you carried on songwriting, but how did you feel emotionally at that time about your life?
Well, I remember saying to him, and every artist would agree with this, you need luck. It doesn't matter how good you are, you need some luck, but you work for that luck. You create your own luck, but you need it. And we'd had our break. We'd got Living in a Box away. We were a brand name to some extent. You know, it's like trying to find that again is really bloody hard, you know. So it was bad times. It was like, well, Jesus, what do we do now? And would I have done anything differently? Would I have just quickly replaced him with somebody? The record company, of course, by that stage, are all going, whoa, shit. You know, we've got a solo artist, so we've just paid more money for that. So Living in a Box, we're not really interested in what you've got to say. And I was a bit burnt from the whole thing and just thought, I'm just not going to do anything for now. I actually don't know what to do. I mean, there are points in life, aren't there, when we go, I don't know what to do. You know, we've all played clever. Oh, yeah, this is all a good idea and this is always a plan. No, I just did not know what to do next. So there were a couple of years, really, more than a couple of years, where I just sort of, I'd met other songwriters that I wrote some songs for other artists, wrote some more songs with Albert Hammond. And without the vehicle to write for, it soon became really apparent that personally, for me, I am not a jobbing songwriter for hire. I admire the guys who are, who can go around and they can read a brief and they can drop a song on and it'll be absolutely spot on. It will be a hit. I am not that guy. I need to be writing songs for me, for my band to do my thing with my ideas. And personally, to me, I can't go out and write a 3-minute pop song for an artist I have no connection with, you know. So that was a very strange time, really, and sort of ended me in the career for about, I suppose I was in the wilderness probably for about 8 years, I should imagine, before I decided that I wanted to do something else, you know.
You're listening to Pop, The History Makers, with me, Steve Blame.
I think that's interesting. It's fascinating that you say 8 years, because when I lost my career and I'd come to Germany, ran a TV channel, lost my career, it was 10 years before I could sit up again and do something else.
Right.
But I look back at that time and I say that completely defined who I am today. And thank God that happened. How do you look back at that dark period? And when did it start changing again? Because I know that you've really moved on into something which is also wonderfully successful.
Well, I think, you know, it does take, you know, you're stunned for a while. And certainly if you're a creative, being stunned, as you will know, is not ideal. It's not like we are accountants and we can go and add some more sums up. You know, it really completely wrecks your emotional center and takes a while to sort of put the pieces back together. And so, you know, I met my wife, we moved on, had a family. I experimented with all sorts of other different things that I wanted to look at, but always came back to music, because at the end of the day, that's what I do. And I love doing it. And I wanted to find a new way to express myself musically where I could retain my control that I just referred to. So I'm writing for a vehicle, for a project that is mine in entirety, in my own control. And I fortunately, I found it once my kids were very young, with the Little Big TV project and Kids Trucks TV, as it's now become. And now we're doing a new series of animation. And that's just grown because I'm a control freak, right? I mean, I just love being able to be totally responsible for things. And that was the problem, I think, in those wilderness years where, I just get pulled from pillar to post and go, oh, yeah, go, you know, my pub should be dropping with all of these individuals, and nothing really worked for me. And so, yeah, I had to take control and find a new creative project. And the industry had changed. So let's not forget, as you well know, the digital revolution, for better or worse, came into play. So what you did as an artist and how you could earn money from it completely collapsed in around 2000. And so it's like, well, you know, YouTube became a thing, but you know, the sort of certain technologies converged to get me excited about what I could possibly do as an independent without having to sign a record deal and sign my life away. I could do it completely off my own bat. And by the mid to late 2000s, it was a sustainable business model to basically make your own programs, which I ended up doing educational programs for kids.
What sort of triggered that, the actual idea? I know you wanted to find something, but what actually triggered this particular thing?
Two things. Having a three-year-old son who stood absolutely aghast every time a tractor went by, or a bus, or a bin lorry, or a digger. You know, it was just like, you know, almost shaking with excitement. And I thought, well, that's an interest, you know, and they all do it. You know, they still do it. Machines, as they will tell you in kids' telly, are king, you know. And my wife, who's from Boston in the States, had just come back from Boston, and she'd her brother, who lives over there, had just bought a VHS of a locked-off camera on a building site, which I think was like number one in the US video chart. And it obviously cost about 30p to put together. And it was shocking. It was awful. But my son loved it. And Tish said to me, well, why don't we do something with your music? Put some songs in it, put a little character in it, or maybe we can get some guys to film some tractors going up and down a field. And so it was her idea. And I thought, well, this sounds great. And we know we've got a ready-made audience in our kids that are at home, you know, ready to sample test it. And so we thought, well, we're living in Chiswick. There aren't many tractors going up and down Chiswick High Road. Better get on the phone and see if we can get some tractor action going. We'll start with tractors. So we phoned up John Deere, who happened to be probably the biggest agricultural machinery company in the world, and blagged about £4.5 million worth of kit in Suffolk. They never asked the question if I'd done this before. Lucky break. Because the answer would have been no. Or I might have blagged it, actually might have blagged it. But anyway, they went, yeah, sure. Well, if you want to film some stuff, there's some machinery in Suffolk that's on test with some farmers. So we got a mate who got a camera. We stood in the field. We filmed the tractors going up and down. And then we thought, well, let's film a farmer and try and get a little bit of a storyline. You know, and I was trying to remember all those shows that I used to watch as a kid that had got that sort of slightly mom and pop, really nice sort of warm feel, but educational. Then I'll start writing a song. So I wrote Here Comes a Tractor, which became this sort of phenomenon. And then we called the show Here Comes a Tractor. We did Here Comes a Fire Engine, Here Comes a Digger, Here Comes a Train. And they went off, and I remember putting it up on YouTube. Nothing happened for about 6 months. In fact, we'd sold them physically on DVDs just before DVDs then passed on and YouTube came its thing. And anyway, on YouTube, nothing happened for about 6 months, 50 views, 500 views, 5,000 views. Oh, okay. And I didn't look at it for about, I don't know, 9 months, 1 million views, 2 million views, 5 million, 15 million. It was like, oh my God, what's happening? And then of course the revenue stream starts to come in, the songs we started to put on, you know, Spotify and Apple Music. And then we got this huge fan base, which was just unbelievable. So I got the magic back.
What do you think that you needed from the business acumen that you must have learned from being a pop star in, you know, from 85 to 90 and having all that success and suffering sort of those failures along the way, as it were, from the record company? What do you think you learned from that time, which has made you make the right decisions for this project?
Well, I think, again, there's a little bit of luck and you know, let's be honest, as you're moving from an analog world selling a physical project to a digital world selling a digital product, that has to exist for me to have been able to do what I did. So that the lay of the land had to be right. And in terms of business, well, you know, you're always looking at a model in terms of trying to work out how much it is it's going to cost you to film this stuff. So relatively cheaply, and also what revenue streams you're going to get. And I didn't really know what revenue streams we were going to get, because I didn't know how many streams you'd need to be able to get some income going on YouTube and what you could do with it. And the power that you would have with it and developing subscribers and a fan base, essentially, that you can say anything to and talk to and communicate and involve in the brand. So I don't know. There are similarities. It's distribution is king, isn't it? It always has been, you know, for artists to try and get their music out there, their artwork out there, or whether it's NFTs now with people doing artwork, or whether it's, you know, Bitcoin and understanding how that works and blockchain and blah, blah, blah. So YouTube, social media, Instagram, so on and so forth. These are all sort of things that I found just naturally very easy to understand and work with, mainly because I've worked with computers and everything from sequencers right through to mixing desks. And so technologically, I understood how it worked. And it was not something I was afraid of. I think what was really nice, as I come back to, is that I could control all the content completely. And as we're working now to start working with animation and understanding how that works and to change the characters and take this project further into something even bigger and books and, you know, all the stuff that you can do in kids' entertainment. That is the new frontier for me and what I'm going to be involved in for the next 5 or 10 years, you know, and I love it. Even though my kids are now at university, but I mean, you know, I'm still tuned into it.
What's the success of Here Comes A, the central factor in you being able to allow yourself to say, okay, why not let's go back on stage? Why not let's reform in inverted commas and be back on stage as Living in a Box? I believe you've done sort of one performance in 2004, but actually to sort of come back as a reformation of Living
well,
in a Box.
Well, there was two. In 2004 was our performance where Richard joined the band. I mean, he came back in. It hadn't worked out for Richard. He got so disillusioned with the music industry, even more so when he got it. I think he found out how hard it really is. And I think I you'd have to ask him, but I think there probably would be regrets there that we were there. You know, we were known. If we got a record company who was making a third album, we should have given it a go. But it didn't work out that way. It didn't work out for Richard once he'd left the band. And so it was quite an easy when we were offered this tour, which was an arena tour. In 2004, I said to him, look, do you want to do it? And he went, well, why not? And we got together and it was great. We really enjoyed it. Richard had made it very clear to me at that stage that although he'd enjoyed it, he's still one of the most nervous performers with this incredible voice and incredible ability to play guitar. It's just astounding to me that he's so terrified, but he didn't feel that he wanted to do it anymore. Some years later, we were offered tours and we go out now and do all the Rewinds and the Let's Rocks, and we still do those, and we're doing some more this year. So we've been touring, doing this sort of, if you like, a hobby thing, which all the artists do, I suppose. Maybe they're topping up their pension pots, and we don't get enough money to do that, but we love doing it. I mean, I think in the day, we didn't do much live work because of MTV. We were basically spending more on a video than a live tour. Technologically it was also a bit tricky because we were using so many sequences and it wasn't as easy as it is now to transfer that, but anyway, the live thing is very much something that I'm hoping we can right the wrong of never really doing it much in the day, in the moment, and do quite a bit of late now doing these wonderful 80s tours which are, you know, all over the place, and we're very much part of that.
Was it a difficult decision at the beginning though, because obviously Richard wasn't a part of this, you know, what you're currently doing, and that's also changed again, but actually like looking for a new vocalist, and playing into that is the fact of the anonymity in the past, in a sense.
Well, yeah.
May have played into the fact that you can be successful with a different vocalist.
Well, this is true. I mean, that is the one upside, as I say, is the anonymity in terms of being able to walk the streets at the time when everything was happening for us was one thing. Many, many decades later, there's nobody's really quite sure. I mean, the real diehard fans obviously know Richard's music inside out, and there was always some kind of phobia about, well, can you imagine trying to replace? I mean, for me personally, I had to get over the fact, well, you know, Richard was so much of a distinctive voice with that booming Michael McDonald versus James Brown edge. You know, I mean, it's like, I mean, how are we going to replace that? And then once I got over the fact that we weren't going to replace it, you know, not usurp it in a way, let's do something else with Living in a Box. Let's why does it need to be specifically that era? It could be anything. We could move on. We could even do new music. That's another conversation, but let's see who's around. And we were offered all these amazing gigs, which we turned down year after year after year. And Richard Titch and I were going, well, bloody hell, we should, you know, we're not going to be here forever. If we're going to do it, let's do it. Let's find somebody. I said, well, we're going to need a singer, dude. You know, well, let's see who we've got. And I just went through my mind, people that I've met who I thought were never going to be possibly how Richard was, but would give a good account of themselves and possibly take it somewhere else. And there's nothing wrong with that. And many artists, as we know, from Queen to Wet, 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 to, you know, loads of them have changed their lead singers. It's just the way of the world, and it can be very successful. So Kenny Thomas's head came into a name came into my head, and we'd been stable mates at Chrysalis Records, called Tempo, and I'd known the stuff that he'd done. And I thought, well, he hasn't got the bite and the oomph necessarily that Rich has got, but he has got the soul, and that's really crucial. So I phoned him up and said, listen, this might sound a bit mad, but we've got some gigs coming up. Do you want to be part of Living in a Box for the gigs? And he went, let me think about it. Next day, he phoned me up, went, yeah, absolutely. You know, I love it. I said, these are the songs we're going to do. He said, oh, Room in Your Heart, sing a song, man. I've got to sing that song. I've always wanted to sing. I used to dance around my bedroom singing that song. To actually sing it to a big audience would be just awesome. And we did, and we did it for 3 years. And we had the most hilarious time. I don't know whether you know Kenny, but he is a bit of a comedian. In fact, if his music business ever fails him any further, then he can have a great career in stand-up. But we had a great laugh, and it was really fun. And it was brilliant to get all the songs back together again and do a bit of Kenny music and a little bit of Living in a Box. And I think people were a bit like, this will be interesting. Living in a Box featuring Kenny Thomas. How's that going to work? But once we'd got there and the promoter saw it, they went, shit, this works really well. This really goes really, really well. And we do a couple of covers to Living in a Box and Kenny Thomas. And there's a couple of shows up on YouTube, I think Live at Lytham, if you look at Living in a Box and Kenny Thomas, that's a bloody good show with a good video, and you can hear it working really well, really well. It's brilliant.
But Kenny's now moved on.
Yes, and Kenny moved on.
And who are you working with now, and why did you choose this person?
So Kenny wanted, you know, we had lockdown and it's tough for everybody. Kenny's been always more of a working musician, has never really stopped. Whereas, as we've been describing with Living in a Box, that's not the case. We've only really dipped our toes back in the live scene relatively recently. And he was offered the opportunity to make a new solo album and to do a tour because it was the 35th anniversary or the 30th anniversary of Voices. I can't remember. Decades have gone by. And so schedule-wise, we were starting to get offered dates. So I was saying, Kenny, we got to this day. And we were like, gosh, I can't do it. And this one was like, oh, now we've got a real problem here. So Kenny, we just decided mutually it was best that Kenny went off and did his thing. And with our blessings, fine, it's all good. But then again, it's like, oh, I've been here before. How many singers can a band have? But again, because we were fairly enigmatic, not so much of a problem. And I'd spoke to a few people, Martin Ware being principally one of them, and again, Martin Fry being another one, who are very close friends, and said, look, I don't want to make a tit of myself. I'm not going to go out trying to drag this smelly old thing around with me and drag it around the clubs and fields of event world. If it's not going to work, I'm not going to flog it to death. I'll just call it a day. I care, but I'm not going to try and drag all the good things that we've done over the years down by just finding anybody who can do anything. And the name Brian J. Chambers came up from both of them, mainly from Martin Ware, who'd worked with a couple of backing singers who I'd also worked with, who'd worked with him when we did a show to raise some money for Kenny's daughter, which I organized for Kenny, and got involved with all the 80s artists that I'd worked with over the years, and Beverly Knight. And Beverly Knight is a good old friend of Kenny's, and Brian Chambers works a lot with Beverly. And so I'd spoken to her about, and it had just become a sort of like, this is the name that seems to be cropping up all the time. And then I got on the internet, as you do, before I contact him, and have a look at what he's done. And I saw his show with Pink Floyd at Pompeii, and he took a couple of lead vocals. I saw the duet that he did with Beverly Knight at the Royal Variety Show, or was a show at the Palladium, I think, in London. And it was just like, oh, this is another Richard. In a way, he's got the power and he's got the grit and the punch, and he he's worked with everybody. I mean, he's just a brilliant session guy, but has also worked, you know, the house scene back in the 90s as a solo act, and ended up in Butlins at 2 o'clock in the morning getting the audience going. So you know he can do that as well. So I asked him, and he thankfully, he thought about it again for a bit and then said, well, why not? Let's do it. So we're going to go out this summer with Brian taking over the lead vocals, and it should be, from what I've heard from our rehearsals, absolutely full on.
Fantastic. Now, you mentioned, obviously, all the way through Titch, who must be a close friend of yours because you've had this close relationship all, you know, throughout the years. Martin Yep. Ware, who I know is a close friend of yours. Martin Fry, ABC, who you wrote songs for on Lexicon Love 2, I think.
And, that's correct.
And he's a close friend. Now, I know that some of you go away on holiday together. What is it about this group of all have been and successful in their life and all have been musicians in their life? What is it that what you have that connects you, or is it something else that sort of deeply connects you? I mean, I think Sheffield is probably a connection as well.
Well, obviously. I mean, I didn't know, I wasn't in a position to know that I sort of, I knew of them in Sheffield as like, bow down to the great ones who had broken through the cellophane line and were all over my television on a Thursday night or whenever it was for Top of the Pops at the time. So it wasn't really until I'd moved to London that I met these guys, which is really strange. I never actually exchanged a word with them in Sheffield because I'd be watching them do a gig and they would be like the gods, you know. So I'd met them in Sheffield because, you know, you just do as you're doing the circuit. And, you know, they were a bit before Living in a Box, but still. And we just hit it off really, really well. And I've been on holidays with Martin Fry and Julie, his wife. And in fact, I had lunch with them about 3 or 4 days ago. We still see a lot of each other. Martin Ware is part of a group that do, as you say, go around on my boys' trip, which we do every year. We're going to San Sebastian in Spain on a culinary foodie thing, and Bilbao to go and see the Guggenheim. We're going in a couple of weeks. And they are all from the north, or, you know, in the music industry. And it is a bit like a busman's holiday. I mean, it really is. Oh, we just potter about and talk about the days and the music industry and what we're all doing now. And, you know, Martin is an octopus of tentacles that go out into all sorts of different things, from whether it's his 3D sound installations to all sorts of other. He's never shy of a project. So I'm usually sitting there in awe listening to what the next thing is, where he's become a professor of this or a whatever it is of that. And we've just become really good buddies, you know, really, really good buddies. You know, he's a godfather to my son, JJ. And, you know, we have just been mates for all these years. And as Sheffield Wednesday fans, we go and see them play whenever we can. He's died in the wall, Sheffield Wednesday. And we just, I don't know, it's weird, isn't it? But we've just become solid buddies, solid.
Now, when I started this podcast interview with you, I said, you know, that you played an important role for me during the 80s because of your music, and plus of someone being on MTV, you know, your videos were on, you know, high rotation a lot of the time. So, in essence, that fed into my life during that era. What fascinated me when I went out to the local cafe actually this morning, and someone asked me, "Oh, what are you doing today?" And I said, "Oh, I'm interviewing Marcus Veer." No reaction. Living in a Box. Oh, Living in a Box. You know, immediately. And they are under 30,
right?
And it's amazing. There's something about Living in a Box which connects different generation. I think it's probably actually that 80s music somehow connects a lot of people. But what do you think it is? Is it because you were on different soundtracks? You're on games soundtracks? You know
what
I mean?
Well, you're right. I mean, wherever I go in the world, you know, you're sitting by a pool somewhere, you get to know someone over a couple of cheeky beers, and they might say, "Well, what do you do?" when they picked up the courage to ask the impudent question. And you say, "Oh, I was in the pop group." And they'll, you can see them mulling it over their head. They could be from anywhere. I was recently in Mexico, for example. And they'll go, anybody we know? And I'll go, "Well, how old are you?" And they'll go, "Well, I'm whatever I am." And I go, "Well, I was in a band called Living in a Box." And they go, "What? What? Have they been living in a cardboard box?" And it's like, yeah, it is that. And then again, maybe another upside to the eponymous nature of it, because if I said we were in the Doohickeys and we had a song called Living in a Box, well, maybe, I don't know. But anyway, so it is really, really well known. But I think in terms of young audiences, first of all, who are, by the way, I know my kids are, but then of course they'd have to be. Age is still, even my kids' mates are big into the 80s. They're really, really big into the 80s. And I think they can hear and smell and feel all that we felt about the individual nature of that music and how different it is. But what fantastic songs and great sounds and risk-taking that went on in terms of the records that went on. Also, because of Grand Theft Auto 5, which Living in a Box was included in their Grand Theft Auto 5, which was in 2013. Became the second biggest selling video game of all time. And that's quite something. And, you know, so you jump in a car and you smash into some grannies pushing prams. and you can turn the radio on in the car and Living in a Box will come on. So you are talking about, 150 million selling product that's introduced our music to that generation. So for sure, a lot of fan base that we get on our socials or stuff that goes through the website and emails are going, "Oh, I just got in the car and I really got into your song, Living in a Box. We've just got into the first album and Gate Crashing. We're also getting into that as well. And it's really sweet how you vertically sell these things from one lead off into a video game, of course, which didn't even exist really in when that song was written, to becoming another launch pad globally. So we were very thankful for them, to Rockstar Games, who put us on that. It was great.
A final note, throughout the interview, you said, right place, right time. I was lucky. It was luck that Richard Derbyshire was in the studio. It was luck that this happened. It was luck that that happened. And even when you talk about your kids' truck TV, you mentioned the word, you know, luck, that you were lucky. But isn't luck basically a combination of talent and possibly, in your case, just being a nice guy? Do you know what I mean?
Well, luck, that's very kind.
You know.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, you know, you can have as much unluck or bad luck as you can have good luck. I'm fairly karmic, as you can tell, you know what I mean? I believe that what you do in good things and the way you deal with people does come back positively or negatively, depending on how you are. Luck, you've got to create it. You've got to have it at the end of the day. I mean, that's what I'm doing with my kids now. You know, they're at university. They're going to just starting to look at what careers they want to go into. And I said, you've got to have the ticket. You've got to get in. You've got to be in the room. So you get your degree or whatever qualifications, your skill set. And then you've got to, obviously, a bit of people skills too. And then a bit of luck will come into you probably meeting the right person who's the right job, got the right job for you. But you've got to make it. You've got to put yourself about. You know, I think as we often hold ourselves back creatively. I know a lot of creatives do because they haven't got the outgoing spirit, but they might be genius programmers or songwriters, but they don't push the music. They don't know the right people because they haven't put themselves in that position. So you earn your luck for sure. You make it. We all know this. And it's sometimes as a creative, the going back to the idea of a box that is not really there. You've just perceived it to be there. And that's what holds you back. So if you can just break through it, get out there and make that luck happen, then maybe you're going to be luckier than someone who doesn't.
Brilliant. That's a wonderful final note. And thank you, Marcus, for your contribution to music, which has been very, very important. And I wish you continued success with all your ventures. And hopefully one day I'll see you on stage in the not too distant future.
Well, I hope so, Steve. Well, thank you for asking me. It's been a real pleasure.
I don't have time to keep up with the latest fitness fads and celebrity workouts. I just need a fitness and nutrition plan that actually gets results. Caliber is a top-rated, science-based fitness program completely customized to my needs and abilities, designed around my schedule. An expert personal trainer keeps me motivated so I stay consistent and see results. Get $100 off Caliber today at CaliberStrong.com/podcast. That's CaliberStrong.com/podcast.
At Sleep Outfitters Outlet, great sleep is a big deal. Save 40 to 60% every day on every Sealy, Stearns & Foster, and Tempur-Pedic. Queens as low as $249. Customer exchanges, closeouts, and floor samples. Inventory changes daily, so come in for your dream deal today. With no credit needed financing, expert advice, and up to 60% off retail, it's never been easier to get the sleep and savings you deserve. Go to sleepoutfittersoutlet.com for financing details and to find a store near you.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands.
Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.